we get started? So the first presentation is Dr. Palmer, from general system theory to general schematic theory. And excuse me, I forgot to mention, we have 2 hours. Plus, between 5 and 6, before dinner, we have 1 extra hour. So we are very free with our time. But don't be feel constrained. Dr. Palmer.
I have copies of my abstract and paper. Okay, great. Okay, my name is Kent Palmer, and I'm going to be talking about from general systems theory to general schemas theory. And this is the basic idea, which is that, you know, we've had a good introduction of what general systems theory is over the last day or so, and there's some quibbling about exactly what the term means and so forth, but more or less everyone here is in agreement that there is such a thing as a system, and there should be a general theory of systems, and then there's a lot of disagreement over what that should be like, right? So, but I'm introducing the idea that there should be something more general than general systems theory, and I don't know if it's been proposed before, but I haven't found it in the literature. And I call it general schemas theory. And I also work as a systems engineer and participate in the systems engineering conferences. And there are these people out there called systems engineers, and they don't know a lot about systems theory. So one of the things I try to tell the systems engineers about is that there is a basis for their discipline, there is an academic discipline of systems theory, and we ought to pay attention to that. But I have a different message for the systems theorists, which is that in order to do systems engineering, we need more than systems theory. And so the systems theorists should be trying to give us a better basis for building our systems. And so I'm advocating at the academic level a movement from general systems theory to what I call general schemas theory, and a movement at the practical level from systems engineering to something I call schemas engineering. So I'm going to explain what that means. You know, I base a lot of my work on the work of Clear, and he wrote this book, Architecture of Systems Problem Solving, which I like a lot. And basically what Clear did is he took 3 different schemas, what I call schemas, and he put it together to create his version of what a general systems theory should be like. And the schemas that he combined was the schema of system, form, and pattern, pattern considered as a structure. So I believe that these different schemas form an emergent hierarchy, and that patterns are different from forms, and forms are different from systems, and there's an emergent hierarchy where each one has its own organization there. And so I am one of the idea of general schemas theory is that we discover all of these schemas, and then we try to understand what are the relations between them. And the reason we want to do that is because the word system has lost its meaning. Systems are applied to everything, right, in our culture. Everything is called a system. And people mean myriad things by that term. And so the term has become relatively meaningless. So the idea is that if you know what the difference is between a system and a form and a pattern, and you understand that, then system suddenly has a meaning again. So that's one of the reasons for doing it. But in this paper, what I'm going to talk about is, and one of the things I'm concerned with in my research, is how do you tell how to differentiate the schemas from each other and how far they are apart in terms of their emergent hierarchy, and how do you understand that. And what I've tried to look into and develop is a mathematical basis for understanding how the emergent hierarchy unfolds, and I think it unfolds in relationship to the dimensional hierarchy from math. So basically, systems theory needs to embrace other schemas besides the system schema, and the system schema gets its meaning from its comparison to the other schemas. Okay, I said that. Okay, so when we talk about schemas, this is my hypothesis about schemas. Over here, you know, in almost all of the presentations so far, we've talked about emergent hierarchies, and they are what, from a fundamental ontology point of view, is an ontic hierarchy. In other words, it's the stuff out there in the world, right? And so from string to Gaia, you know, there's some hierarchy there, and we're trying to discover what it is, and different people cut up that spectrum in different ways, and I'm not concerned about how that's cut up. Okay, what I'm concerned about is what I call the schemas hierarchy, which I say is ontological rather than ontic. And the reason I call it ontological is that these things are things that we project upon the things out there in the world, right? They come from us as a projection. And we could project onto, say, the organism different ones of these schemas, okay? And the different schemas we project cause us to see completely different attributes in the phenomena. And a lot of the arguments that we see among specialists is because one of them is saying that the organism is like a system, and another is saying it's like a form, and another is saying it's like a pattern. And of course, they're going to see different things if they project those different schemas onto the particular ontic phenomena out there in the world. Now, this particular hierarchy is just a hypothesis, and it comes from a reading of the very wide reading of the various disciplines, and an attempt to synthesize what might be this ontological hierarchy. And the thing is that you can see is that just like the ontic hierarchy, it's scalar too. In other words, it starts with very small things and goes toward very big things, and the whole point of coming up with this hypothesis as to what this ontological hierarchy is to figure out, okay, now what's the space between each one of these, And then what's the different organization from one to the other? And then how do they fit like Russian dolls into each other? In other words, how do you go from a pattern to a form? How do you go from a form to a system? I mean, they're emergent. It's an emergent hierarchy, so there's new properties at the next higher level. But there's also supervenience. In other words, there's also a dependency on the lower level. And so, how does that dependency on the lower level get articulated as you move up this hierarchy of projections? And so, the thing that I, and where this comes from is I take a phenomenological view, right? The phenomenological view is there are no systems out in the world, right? We draw the lines where systems are, wherever we see them, and so there is some phenomena out in the world. We project schemas on that phenomena, and then it's through the anomalies in that projection process that we discover more about what is really out there. And that's what we call science, is when we just automatically project schemas like Aristotle did in his science. We just automatically decide that things have intrinsic value and have goals, teleology or whatever. We just decide that. And then there's all these little anomalies that come up, and eventually we have to say, okay, some things don't have inbuilt goals like Aristotle thought they did. So the idea is that we project these schemas just involuntarily onto phenomena, and that science is the whole messy business of distinguishing our projections from what's really out there through the anomalies. So given that hypothesis, this is a result of my work. And, 'cause, I mean, the kind of like summary of this is that there's two schemas per dimension and two dimensions per schema. And this is the concept, that we have these schemas that are distinguished from each other, and each one has a gap between them, and they're unfolding in some kind of mathematical way. And so I believe that the mathematical way in which they're unfolding is through the unfolding of dimensionality. But the schemas are not the same as dimensionality. It's like dimensionality is the skeleton on which the schemas are formed. And the way it works is that given a particular schema, like pattern, right, it can operate at one dimensions or two dimensions, right? And form can operate at two dimensions and three dimensions. And system can operate at three dimensions and four dimensions. And what we're missing is the fact that there are higher level schemas that can operate at higher level dimensions. And there are disciplines which have focused on some of these higher level dimensions, but what happens is that the schemas are developed within within specific disciplines in discipline specific terminology. And people don't go around collecting these, examples of these, and they don't notice that in another discipline they've developed the same schema and they just called it by different terms. And so, but if you go around and you kind of try to do that work, then I believe that you start recognizing that there are these different schemas that are being talked about, and in some disciplines they try to develop these higher level schemas. And that what we're missing is these higher level schemas. And the importance of them is that a system can only support so much explanatory value. And that if you want to describe something more complex than a system, you need a schema that has higher dimensionality to support that higher complexity. And so the concept here is that like a pattern, an example of a pattern is that like say you have a colored thread, right? So that's one dimensional. But then you take those colored threads and you weave them together into a cloth, and that's two-dimensional, right? But then the thing is that when you go up to a form, right, then there are patterns that are two-dimensional and there's forms that are two-dimensional, you know? And so like these paintings back here on the wall, they are two-dimensional, but we see forms in them. We see trees and people and horses in there because they've delineated a boundary, and then they colored in such a way that we see a representation of a three-dimensional thing in a two-dimensional form. And so form operates on a two-dimensional level and a three-dimensional level, and then systems, there can be three-dimensional systems, and then three-dimensional forms and three-dimensional systems. A static system is usually a group of objects in three dimensions, right, and their relations. But then we can add time in, and so then we can get dynamic systems if we add time in. And so my idea is that if you follow the dimensionality up, there would be a schema at each one of these dimensional levels, and they would have their own organization and their own complexity. Now, we have a fundamental problem in our culture, which is that this level here, you notice that, you know, I picked out names for things that are fairly generic, but it turns out that at this level here, just beyond the system, for some reason, in our language, we don't have a word for that. And so because we have a blind spot right at this point here, just the next level beyond the system, we have huge problems with ecology and dealing with the environment and dealing with the effects of systems. We build systems and they have effects in the environment that we don't recognize. And that's what the reason is. We have a blind spot here and we have a difficulty recognizing the environmental effects of the systems we design. So I've been searching and searching for a name for this that's generic. And I used to call these meta systems, and I still do sometimes. But I discovered that what I was calling a meta system, there actually is an English term for it, which is scape. And the reason I never noticed it was that, you know, we talk about mindscapes, we talk about landscapes, we talk about seascapes, we talk about all kinds of scapes. And it turns out that when you look into the definition of that word and the root of that word, it has that essential thing that I was looking for that I was calling a meta system. But the problem with it is that it's always connected with something else, right? Which is kind of interesting because it's all about the connections between all of the things, right? And so I decided to rename this thing an openscape because the word open is like a variable in which you can insert whatever designator that you need to insert to delimit that. But I'm happy with the idea of metasystem as well. So this is the way that I see it, that there's dimensional unfolding here, and that there's a specific relationship between the dimensional unfolding and the schema unfolding, such that there are two dimensions per schema and two schemas per dimension. Now, I wrote another paper where I tried to consider, now, why would this be the case if it is true? And what I came up with is that there is, well, one of the philosophers I'm interested in is Deleuze, and in Indifference and Repetition, he makes a distinction between representations and repetitions, right? And so, using his terminology, as we go down in this schema, down this set of schemas, what happens is that we produce representations. So we produce two-dimensional representations of three-dimensional forms, right? And so as we're going down, we're producing representations. As we're going up, we're doing what he calls repetition, right? In other words, if you want to take, like if you think of plans for a building, right? you'll have the ground plan, then you'll have a front view, then you'll have a side view. Those are repetitions. Each one of those two-dimensional views are repetitions to try to approximate this three-dimensional thing. And that's what we do as we go up, is we go through a repetition transformation. And the thing that Deleuze says about repetition is that, unfortunately, he says it at the end of his book rather than the beginning, but basically he says that repetitions don't repeat. In other words, you can't ever get there by a repetition. Like, for instance, sacrifices, you know. I mean, in the Indo-European tradition, the idea was that there was a giant, which was the whole of the universe, and it was sacrificed, and all the stuff that we see here is part of that giant, all cut up. And then what we do is we do repetitions of sacrifices in order to try to get back to that wholeness. Okay, but no matter how many animals we kill and dismember, we'll never get back to wholeness, right? And so the same thing is true here of these repetitions. No matter how many plans you have of a building, it's different from the building. I mean, you're never going to get to a complete vision of the building by all of these plans. So that's what's happening as we're going up here. And then the other thing that's interesting about this, if you consider it in terms of Heidegger, philosophy, is that he talks about Dasein and the ecstasy of Dasein projecting. And what's interesting here is that is in this schematic pattern, you know, I mean, he's talking about the Dasein projecting intelligibility on the world, and what's happening in this schematic pattern is we're kind of projecting a pre-intelligibility on the world, but you can see where the ecstasy comes from because, you know, there's a certain place where space-time is, you know, between at the fourth dimension here is where space-time is, and we're kind of trapped in space-time. But the ecstasy part of it is that we're projecting patterns that go beyond the actual dimensionality that we're trapped in. So I see this as an example of what Heidegger's talking about when he talks about that. The projection, the ecstasy of Dasein. And one of the things I'm working on right now, and this is really actually a bad presentation of it, but is the, you know, there's a, you know, like Nietzsche did a genealogy of morals. You know, you can do a genealogy of a term in our tradition, right? And so what I'm working on is a genealogy of the concept of schema, you know, where it first entered the tradition and then how it was transformed as we went along. And it's definitely what I've discovered is that the, first really clear example is Protagoras, right, and his concept of man is the measure of all things. And because you can see that dimension, that unfolding of the schemas as a measurement of the world. And so the idea is that Protagoras and Plato, they established form as the fundamental schema for our whole tradition. And from the time of Plato up until the last century, form was it, right? It was the major schema. And then what happened in the last century is structuralism went off and created pattern as an important schema to look at, and then the system schema. And so the system and structure in the last century became two important schemas that were developed in order to get away from form, you know. And then Democritus had the monad as a form, but then when physics comes along and finds things like quarks that can never be separated, right? So that's the development of another schema, right? And then Heidegger comes along and he talks about worlds and Dasein's projection of the world. And then we also had the development in the last part of the last century of ecosystems, environments, situations, contexts, this thing I call openscapes or metasystems. And then we're working up to these higher and higher schemas unfolding. So this is not the structure of the genealogy. This is just like a notional idea of what a genealogy might look like. And one of the things I'm trying to work on is what is that, what's the real genealogy of the term schema? And then I'd like to mention, just parenthetically, that I have another theory that I've worked out, which is called special systems theory. And actually how I got into this research was by looking at special systems theory. And because what happens is that there are, there's a system and then there's a metasystem, okay, which I see as the environment or the ecosystem or whatever, which I'm calling an openscape. And then what I discovered is that between those two, there are these partial systems, partial metasystems that are like threshold, sub-thresholds. And so I call them dissipative, autopoietic, and reflexive. I call this one dissipative because it's based on Prigogine's theory, and autopoietic based on Maturana's theory. And then there's someone called Barry Sandywell and John O'Malley that talk about reflexive systems in sociology. And so one of the things I realized recently is that these correspond in Heidegger to what he calls Dasein, and he calls the autopoietic being with, and the reflexive Das Man. And so one of the interesting things about this hierarchy is that this pattern repeats itself at every level. So not only do you have these large striations, right, of between the different levels, but you have these substriations, and they become very apparent at the four-dimensional level between the system and the metasystem. So like Heidegger talks about being in the world. Dasein means being in the world. But he's only talking about one schema, right? But actually you can think about this in terms of being in any of these schemas. That there's Dasein is projecting the schemas, and it doesn't have to just project the world schema. It can project schemas at all these different scales. And another point, which is more difficult to get across easily, but one of the things that happened was that when Heidegger, it's all rooted in Husserl, but really Heidegger brought it to the fore, is that he basically said that being has different modalities. And he differentiated the ready-to-hand and the present-in-hand modalities. And that, like, opened up Pandora's box. And so people started running out and trying to identify different modalities of being. And Heidegger himself identified more modalities of being. And so it turns out that one way to understand these modalities of being is in terms of meta-levels of being. And that the... and so basically Heidegger said there were two modalities of being, pure being, which is static, like Parmenides, and then you've got process being, which is dynamic, like Heraclitus's kind of being. And Heidegger said, well, both of these modalities are equiprimordial. In other words, they both stand at the same time, and we keep switching between them in our culture, and we don't have to say that one is more basic than the other. Human beings are made up of these different modalities. But then he went on to identify what the next higher meta level, which is hyperbeing, and he called it being crossed out. Derrida calls it difference. And then Merleau-Ponty came along and identified the next higher meta level of being, which is wild being. And so what happened was that I believed for a long period of time that there were only these four kinds of being. And what happened is you just kind of fell off a cliff when you got higher than got to the fifth meta level of being, because you fell into existence, right? And once you can't project anymore, then it's just what exists, what you find there, rather than being part of your projection process. And I held this view for a long period of time, but then, just like I was saying with the schemas, what happened was certain anomalies started appearing, and I realized that there was a fifth meta-level of being, right, which I call ultra-being. And the interesting thing about this is that that ultra-being, you know, these kinds of being are all meta-levels of a projection process. But what happens when you go over this discontinuity of existence is that rather than being in the world, you're being out of the world. In other words, you're looking at projection from the outside, which is a possibility that I didn't understand before. And what's interesting about that is that I'm starting to believe that schemas themselves have this kind of being, of ultra being. Because when you think about it, and I call it kind of like impure existence, that when you think about it, the schema, there's only 10 schemas, right? And everything that we experience in a dimensional form, right? And so the very first thing that has to happen when we experience something is that we have to recognize its dimensional form and put it into a schema. And so the schemas are the place where the whatever is out there interacts with our projections, and it interacts with them from the outside. And so that's this level of ultra being. And I think that one of the interesting things about this research is that it's led me to understand that my understanding of this projection process was limited, and that I needed to come up to a higher level, one of these higher meta levels of being, in order to understand it better. How am I doing?
Good.
Time to stop?
No, 5 more minutes.
Okay. So if you go up there to meta level 5, and anybody can do that, because all you have to do is repeat the same word over and over to get up there. And so, if you, recently we were looking at some sonnets by Shakespeare. And in these sonnets by Shakespeare, he talks about living life, and then talks about the death of death. And by the death of death, he's suggesting immortality, right? So he's suggesting something different than death happens when you have the death of death. And so so when you're going up these meta levels, basically whatever it is, this term, you just keep repeating it with a different meaning at each level, and that's how you walk up the meta levels to get to meta level 5. But what's interesting is when you get to meta level 5, there's two main interpretations of what meta level 5 is. And one of them is the Buddhist one of emptiness, and the other one is the Taoist one of void. And so one of the things that's kind of interesting that I've discovered is that when you get up to that level, there is this specific difference between emptiness and void. You know, I mean, the Buddhists don't believe the external world exists at all. Okay, so there's only consciousness, and consciousness is empty, and therefore you can experience something called interpenetration. The Taoists, on the other hand, believe that everything is nature, and the social and consciousness is nothing else than nature, and there's no difference, right? Those are two radically different views, but but there is some similarity between, I mean, once you posit that, there is some similarity between emptiness and void, but there's still a difference. And I just ran in on the internet someone called Guz, who has a site at emptysets.org or emptysets.com, which talks about infinite empty sets, right? And one way of thinking about the difference between emptiness and void is in terms of sets and masses, or count and non-count ways of looking at things. And you can think of void as infinite empty masses. And so what's interesting is that this ultra being, right, is like the difference between emptiness and void, and it's the externality of the projection of being by Dasein as being in the schema. And so ultra being has a role to play in differentiating between emptiness and void, and if you go up to the next meta level, that difference collapses at meta level 6, and you just have pure existence. So, so anyway, that's an interesting point. Let's see. If there's anything else that's interesting to say. Okay, I'll just put this up there. Maybe this will make a little bit of sense. In our worldview, there's a fundamental distinction between physos and logos. And so if you use that fundamental distinction, one of the ways to getting at what a schema is to look at the physos of the logos and the logos of the physos, right? And the physos of the logos is logic. In other words, in language, there's certain things you just cannot do and make sense. And so those things that you cannot do and make sense are encapsulated in logic. So there are some fundamental constraints in the use of language that we impose as logic. But and then between the physos and the logos is order as a kind of non-dual that's over here. So we have this, and then order, we can talk about all different kinds of order, so that's mathesis. So these two sides we really have down in our culture. We really understand logic, you know, in philosophy, and we really understand math, right? But one thing we just don't understand very well is this thing I call the schema, which is the logos of the physos. In other words, when we do a projection on nature, what we're doing is we are instigating a conversation with nature by projecting a pattern on it and seeing whether that pattern works or not. And so, in a way, the schema is a way for nature to talk back to us through the anomalies that are produced from the projection process. And without that prior projection process of our understanding, we don't get any response from nature. And so if you, this is an area where we're weak in our understanding of what the schemas are. We don't know how many there are. We don't know how they're related to each other. And so what I'm suggesting in my research is that we should try to fill this in and understand what these schemas are. And then we can talk about the relationships between these, because the relationship between logic and math, we have model theory in math, right? And the relationship between logic and the schemas, or what's out there in the world, is through philosophical category theory. And the relationship between math and the schemas is through representation theory. So if we had a better understanding of what the schemas were, then we could work through these different relationships and have a better understanding of science, I believe. Okay, so anyway, that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there any questions?
Because in my understanding of the system is that the system operates at either three dimensions and four dimensions, right? And the meta system is between four and five, and space-time is four-dimensional. So it's right there between the four-dimensional system and the four-dimensional environment, right? And so that four-dimensionality is a crucial boundary. And we happen to live in a four-dimensional world, right? And so everything above that is projection of higher dimensionality than we actually experience directly. But still, we organize domains, we organize worlds, we organize along these higher schemas, but we don't experience it directly, you know.
And the second is observation. You say that's man. Is it taken from German?
Yeah, Heidegger.
But man is not, that is there, man. It's just a great observation of language. You don't say that's man, that is correct, is there, man.
I'm just, what I've learned is that the, you know, Heidegger uses this term, Das Man. He makes up a lot of terms in Being and Time. So I suggest you look at Being and Time and tell me if I'm wrong after you've looked at Being and Time. He makes up these terms.
If he makes up some special meaning, it's not different.
Yeah, no, he does make up special
meaning.
Yeah, he does make up terms. And so I think this is one of his made-up terms. Right.
So if you took something like, at least one of the ways I think of the world in terms of faith, there's evolution and then death within evolution is in the epistemology. So like how, if you have some other scheme like that, or think in terms of the world, are you saying it could map onto those dimensions or that this is just one set of...
No. One of the things that I've realized that I didn't present, I took it out of this presentation because I knew I'd never get to it, is that, you know, a concept that we haven't developed is meta-dimensionality. Okay, and so one of the things we can think about is we've got dimensions, and then we have meta-dimensions. Now, what does that mean? And then we meta-meta-dimensions, what does that mean? And one of the things I realized was that these things I'm calling the kinds of being, right? I call them standings because some of them are standings in existence, some of them are standings in being, depending on whether the projection's there or not. Those are meta-dimensions, right? And that there's another kind of being, which are the aspects, which are identity, presence, truth, and reality. Those are meta-meta-dimensions. And so there's this interesting thing that there's the finite, there's infinite dimensions, but I'm saying there's 10 schemas, right? And there's infinite meta-dimensions, but I'm saying there's 7 standings. And then there's infinite meta-meta-dimensions, but I'm saying there's 4 aspects to being. It's not just me saying that. I mean, it's partly in the tradition. So there's this interesting thing about the relationship between these what we talk about being, a lot of it is just talking about meta-dimensions, meta-meta-dimensions, and that gives a way of bringing in maybe these other things that you're talking about.
Is there any other questions?
Oh, thank you very much.
You go ahead. Carl, you can put up. So, a Buddhist story is that years ago, the Indians had developed philosophy and Buddhism came from India.
Uh-huh.
And they got really highly advanced and formed a most perfect society, but they realized they're going to be overrun by the barbarians. So what were they going to do? So they saw the Tibetans and said, look at these guys up there. They're not warlike. They're going to keep people out of their boundaries, not going to fight each other. They could really highly develop it. So they gave Buddhism to Tibetans and let them develop it for hundreds of years, of course, until eventually there was exchange with the Chinese, at which point Buddhism was overlaid on Taoism, okay? Because you mentioned these two things.
Right.
And then eventually the Chinese gave it to Japan, where it became Zen Buddhism. So in theory, Zen Buddhism is that you talked about overlaid on top of Taoism. I don't know in practice.
Right. I'd like to suggest a book. There's Stonehouse, who is a Zen monk who was also a Taoist, and he has places in his poetry, Stonehouse's poetry, where one line is an emptiness line, and the next line is a void line. The next line is an emptiness line, and the next line is a void line. So it's very interesting to look at someone like that, who's actually distinguishing between the two things, emptiness and void, but juxtaposing them very closely And in fact, Korean Buddhism basically traces itself back to Stonehouse. So anyway, that's just an interesting point.
And going back, it's not it. And the other interesting thing about those stories, it's not a tragedy, but the same time the Orient Tibet and the history of Tibet, because we have certain knowledge, not only the property of the rest of the world, but also about the monasteries and the people's background.
Okay, so the next presentation is going to go to the Council of Skins, managing Europe.
Thank you.
Gratitude.